Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hi there, Erman and Corin. So out of curiosity, I decided that it would be a fun and interesting idea to try out GPT-1. And I was actually looking not for GPT-1 specifically, the AI model, but for an AI model that could still be used, but which would represent the very early days of AI before it got good. And I wasn't really sure what I was expecting out of this experiment, but I thought it would be a good point of comparison to see how far AI has truly come. And I did find that GPT-1 from OpenAI is actually very easy to use in the sense that it's out there on Hugging Face, and you can just download the model. By today's standards, it's very small, but you don't even need to do that. You can just demo it online. And I guess I was expecting kind of a piecemeal or like kind of an early version of today's models like ChatGPT 3.5 or 4, but it was really not that. It was a very bizarre experience. For anyone who's used it, it's a bit like you'll say something and there is about one turn. You might say like, how are you? And you'll get a refusal. I am a AI model. I do not have feelings. So it hasn't been tuned for conversation, but you could ask. You could kind of work around that by saying, what is the capital of France? And it will say Paris. And then you would respond with, well, is Paris a city or a village? And it would say Paris is a village. And then it's when it starts to get weird. The context window is so small that after about the third turn in the conversation, it starts outputting gibberish. And then it just kept outputting gibberish and more gibberish. So the whole conversation was after asking, you know, to say, well, Paris is a city, then you'd say, is it a big city or a small city? And then it was kind of like at this point, it would just go off the walls and just start repeating ad infinitum if you're using a terminal. So my question is, Herman and Corin, I've always wondered about models like this. BERT comes up a lot, and I assumed that they were a lot better than they actually were. It really feels like they weren't ready for use yet. But if I'm not mistaken, is GPT-1 not after the Transformer model, which I thought was kind of the landmark in when AI got really good? And if so, why is it so bad? And out of curiosity, I can understand, having used them, why these models weren't widespread consumer tools, because you use them and say, this technology is crap. But they were in use, as I understand, in those early days for various linguistic tasks. So we talked about the history of AI in a previous podcast and how it kind of just seemed to appear out of the blue. But I'd love to know, around that period when these models were just coming out, what kind of applications were they seeing? Like, were these already being prototyped as chatbots? And how was this very limited ability actually used in practice? Herman and Corin, let's talk about GPT-1 and the first wave of AI chatbots.
All right, we have a really fun one today. Our housemaid Daniel has been doing some digital archaeology in the back rooms of the internet.
Herman Poppleberry here. And yeah, Daniel was actually playing around with GPT-1, which for anyone who joined the AI party in the last couple of years, probably feels like trying to use a stone tool to build a skyscraper.
It is wild. He sent us this audio where he was basically poking at it with a stick and getting frustrated because it kept calling Paris a village and then devolved into absolute gibberish after three sentences. It's such a perfect starting point for us because GPT-1 is often cited as this massive landmark, but if you actually use it today, it feels, well, broken.
It's not broken, Corn. It's just primitive. Think of it like the Wright brothers' first flyer. It stayed in the air for 12 seconds and traveled 120 feet. If you tried to use it to fly from Jerusalem to New York today, you'd call it a failure. But at the time, the fact that it flew at all changed the world.
That's a fair analogy. But Daniel's question is really the core of it. Why does it seem so much less capable? I mean, it's still a transformer, right? The T in GPT stands for transformer. That's the same architecture we're using for the massive models today. So what happened between the June 11, 2018 GPT-1 paper and now?
A lot of things, but the biggest one is scale. OpenAI published the GPT-1 paper on June 11, 2018, with the model having 117 million parameters. Now, to a regular person, 100 million sounds like a lot. But compared to what we're working with in 2026, it's a grain of sand. For context, GPT-4's parameter count is undisclosed by OpenAI, but estimated by third parties at around 1.8 trillion in a mixture of expert setup, and the models we're seeing this year are pushing even further into agentic autonomy. That is roughly a 15,000-fold increase in raw capacity since the original.
15,000 times. That's like comparing the brain of a fruit fly to a human. But it's not just the size, right? Because Daniel mentioned the context window. He said it started outputting gibberish after just a few turns.
Exactly. The context window on GPT-1 was only 512 tokens. In modern terms, that's maybe a page of text. But here's the technical kicker. It used what we call absolute positional embeddings. That means the model literally had a hard-coded limit. It couldn't see token 513 if it wanted to. Once it hit that limit, it didn't have the sophisticated forgetting or attention mechanisms we have now to stay on track. It would just start attending to its own previous errors, creating a feedback loop of nonsense. If it made one typo or one weird word choice, it would get distracted by its own mistake and just spiral.
I love that image of the model getting distracted by its own shadow. But there's another part of Daniel's experience that I think is really important. He mentioned that he asked, "How are you?" And it gave him a very cold, robotic, "I am an AI model. I do not have feelings." He noted it wasn't tuned for conversation, and I think this is where a lot of people get confused. We think of GPT as a chatbot, but GPT-1 was never intended to be a chatbot, was it?
Not even close. This is the biggest misconception about early large language models. Back in 2018, the goal wasn't, "Let's make a digital friend." The goal was, "Let's see if we can predict the next word in a sentence well enough to understand language." GPT-1 was a proof of concept for something called unsupervised pre-training. Before this, if you wanted an AI to do sentiment analysis, you had to train it specifically on a data set of labeled happy and sad sentences.
Right. The supervised approach. You had to hold the model's hand for every specific task.
Exactly. OpenAI's big gamble with GPT-1 was saying, "Hey, what if we just feed it a ton of books and let it figure out how language works on its own by trying to guess the next word?" They used the book corpus dataset, which contained over 11,000 books scraped from Smashwords, mostly romance, fantasy, and adventure novels.
Wait, unpublished books. So GPT-1's entire worldview was shaped by aspiring novelists writing about dragons and star-crossed lovers.
Pretty much. That's why it has that weird, slightly dramatic flair sometimes. It was literally trained on the tropes of indie romance and sci-fi. But the point was that, after it read those books, it had a general understanding of English. Then, if you wanted it to do a specific task, you would fine-tune it. You'd give it a much smaller, specific data set for, say, answering questions. But the base model, the one Daniel was playing with, was just a raw text predictor. It had no idea it was supposed to be talking to a human.
This is such a crucial distinction. Today, when we use a model, we're actually using a very layered cake. You have the base model that's read the whole internet, then you have the instruction tuning where it learns to follow commands, and then you have RLHF reinforcement learning from human feedback, where humans literally rate its answers to make it sound more helpful and pleasant.
Right? GPT-1 had zero of that. No instruction tuning, no RLHF, no safety filters. It was just a raw engine. If you asked it a question, it wasn't trying to answer you, it was trying to complete the document. If your prompt looked like the start of a Q&A, it might try to act like a Q&A. But if it got confused, it might decide the best next word was just the letter A repeated 100 times.
It's like the difference between an engine sitting on a workbench and a finished Tesla. Daniel was basically trying to drive the engine block and wondering why there were no cup holders or a steering wheel.
That is a perfect way to put it. And to address Daniel's point about BERT, because he mentioned that name comes up a lot. BERT was Google's big model released just a few months after GPT-1. BERT was an encoder-only model, while GPT was decoder-only. BERT was actually better at a lot of things back then, like understanding the relationship between words in a sentence, because it could look at a word and see the context both before and after it. BERT Large scored around 84.9 on the GLU benchmark, while GPT-1 excelled on generation tasks like LA Beta.
Oh, I remember this. Bidirectional encoder representations from Transformers.
Look at you with the full acronym. Yeah, BERT was the king of understanding, but GPT was the king of generating. Because GPT only looks at what came before, it's much better at actually writing new text. And it turns out, as we've seen over the last 8 years, the generating path was the one that led to general intelligence. If you can generate the next word perfectly, you have to understand the world.
So, if GPT-1 wasn't a chatbot, what were people actually using it for in 2018? I mean, was there any practical application? Or was it just a lab experiment?
It was mostly a benchmark buster. GPT-1 came out and absolutely smashed the state-of-the-art on 9 out of 12 of the tests they used at the time. That was the aha moment for the industry. It proved that pre-training on a generic dataset actually helped the model perform better on specific tasks it had never seen before. It was the birth of the foundation model.
That's the generative pre-trained part. The pre-trained is the revolution.
Exactly. Before that, everyone thought you needed specialized architectures for every task. GPT-1 said, no, just give me a big enough transformer and enough books, and I can learn to do anything with just a little bit of extra training.
It's interesting, though, because Daniel's experience with it outputting gibberish highlights how much we take for granted now. We expect these models to be coherent for thousands of words. But back then, even getting a paragraph that didn't contradict itself was a win. I remember reading that GPT-2, the successor, was the one where people started getting actually worried about its ability to generate deceptive or too convincing text.
Yeah, GPT-2 was the one where OpenAI initially said, this is too dangerous to release, which, looking back at it from 2026, feels almost adorable. GPT-2 had 1.5 billion parameters. It was 10 times bigger than GPT-1, and that jump in scale was enough to make the text go from mostly gibberish to, wait, did a human write this?
It's that exponential curve. But let's go back to Daniel's question about early applications. Were there any prototypes for chatbots back then using GPT-1?
There were some very early experiments, but they were mostly in the creative writing space. People would use it to help them write stories. You'd write a sentence, and the model would give you the next one. It was very collaborative because the model was so unstable that the human had to do all the heavy lifting to keep the story on the rails. It was more like a sophisticated autocomplete than a conversation.
I actually remember a few AI dungeon-style games that started around then. They were using these early models to try and generate infinite adventure stories. And yeah, they were notorious for having the characters suddenly turn into inanimate objects, or the plot just dissolving into a loop about a dark and stormy night.
Right, and that brings us back to the context window. If the model can only remember the last 500 words, it's going to forget that you're holding a sword or that you're in a cave. By the time you get to the end of the page, the beginning of the page is gone from its memory. It's like a goldfish trying to write a novel.
A goldfish on romance novels. It's a hilarious image. But okay, so if we look at where we are now, today is January 20th, 2026. We're seeing models that can process millions of tokens. We're talking about infinite context windows, or at least windows large enough to hold an entire library. When you look back at GPT-1 from this vantage point, does it feel like a dead end or a direct ancestor?
Oh, it's a direct ancestor. Absolutely. The core idea, unsupervised pre-training on a decoder-only transformer, is still the heart of everything. We just added more layers, more parameters, better data, and that crucial alignment layer that makes it talk like a person. If you stripped away all the safety filters and the instruction tuning from GPT-5 today, you'd still see the ghost of GPT-1 in there. It's just a much, much smarter ghost.
It's like looking at the first single-celled organism. It's not bad at being an organism, it's just the starting point. I think what's really fascinating is that Daniel was able to just download it and run it. That's another huge change. In 2018, running a 100 million parameter model required some decent hardware. Now, you can run it on a phone or even in a browser.
Yeah, the smallness of it is now its greatest feature. We use models that size for very specific tiny tasks now, like, is this email spam? Or, what is the sentiment of this tweet? We don't need a trillion parameters to tell us a tweet is angry. So GPT-1's size has actually become the standard for edge AI.
That's a great point. We've gone through this cycle where we built these massive, godlike models, and now we're trying to shrink that intelligence back down into small models that are the same size as GPT-1, but way more capable because the training techniques have improved so much.
Exactly. A small model today with 100 million parameters would absolutely smoke GPT-1, even though they're the same size. We have better data now. We don't just use over 11,000 unpublished books, we use high-quality synthetic data, curated web scrapes, and textbooks. The quality of the reading material matters just as much as the brain size.
So, for the listeners who want to try this themselves, because it is a trip, what should they look for? If they go to a site like Hugging Face and pull up these ancient models, what's the best way to interact with them to see what they were actually meant for?
Don't treat it like a chatbot. Treat it like a complete the sentence game. Give it a very clear, structured start. Like, the capital of France is, and see if it says Paris. Or start a story with a very specific style and see if it can mimic it for 3 sentences. If you try to argue with it or ask it for its opinion, you're just going to get the gibberish Daniel found. It's a mirror, not a person.
It's a mirror that's been shattered and glued back together. I think the takeaway for me is just the sheer speed of this. We're talking about less than 8 years. In 8 years, we went from a model that couldn't stay on topic for a paragraph to models that are passing bar exams and diagnosing rare diseases.
It's the fastest technological ramp-up in human history. And I think it's important to remember that people were blown away by GPT-1 at the time. There were headlines about how OpenAI's new model understands language better than ever. We were impressed by the village of Paris back then because before that, models couldn't even get Paris right half the time.
It's all about perspective. I remember being impressed by my first flip phone because it could send a text message. Now I'm annoyed if my watch doesn't translate a foreign language in real time. We're very good at moving the goalposts on impressive.
We really are. But I think there's something beautiful about going back and looking at these early versions. It reminds you that this isn't magic, it's engineering, it's math, it's trial and error. GPT-1 was a very successful error that pointed the way to everything else.
Well, I think we've thoroughly dissected the village of Paris. This was a great prompt from Daniel. It's easy to forget the history when the future is moving so fast.
Definitely. And hey, if you're out there listening and you've been enjoying these deep dives into the weird side of AI and tech, we'd really appreciate it if you could leave us a review on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. It actually helps a lot more than you'd think.
Yeah, it keeps the lights on and the sloths fed. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com if you want to send in your own prompt. Maybe you found an old AI in a digital basement somewhere that we should talk about.
Or just a question that's been bugging you. We're here for all of it.
All right, that's episode 226. Thanks for hanging out with us in Jerusalem. I'm Korn.
And I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll talk to you next week.
Stay curious, everyone.
And keep poking the models with sticks. It's the only way to learn.
Exactly. Bye, everyone.
Good no. Bye.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.